Hello and welcome to Key Voices. Today we are going to discuss a very important topic, how to make schools safer spaces for pupils who identify as LGBTQ+. My name is Nicola West-Jones and I'm the Director for Insights and External Relations at the Key Support Services. This discussion is part of the Key's response to the insights from the Pupil Safeguarding Review. Insights from the review show that children who identify as LGBTQ+ are more likely to feel unsafe in school than their heterosexual peers. So if we know through this new research that children identifying as LGBTQ+ are more likely to feel unsafe in school, what can school and trust leaders do about this? Just before I introduce our brilliant panel, it's important to say that the Key does not support a particular political platform or set of beliefs. Instead, we focus on how we can help sector leaders navigate the challenges they face and act in the best interests of all the children in their care. So now it's a pleasure to introduce our wonderful panellists. First up, I'd like to welcome Evie Cryer, who uses she, her pronouns. Evie is the LGBTQ+ advocate for staff and students of Oasis Community Learning. That's comprising 52 schools across 5 regions in England. And Evie leads a network of dedicated and passionate Oasis staff. This is a role she balances with being a Year 6 teacher. She's in her Year 6 classroom right now. A Year 6 teacher and academy reading leader, as well as being a wife, a mum to 3 wonderful humans, and an active part of the LGBTQ+ and deaf communities as a freelance writer. Welcome, Evie. And our other panel member is Jo Brassington. Jo, who uses they, them pronouns, is a former primary school teacher and middle leader. They co-founded Pride and Progress, which is a podcast and platform amplifying the voices of LGBTQ+ educators and exploring ways to reimagine our schools as more inclusive spaces. Jo is now an educator, trainer, and speaker, working with schools, universities, and charities around LGBTQ+ inclusion, as well as children's mental well-being. So first up, let's hear a little bit about our panelists' experience in this space from their perspectives. And I'd like to start with Evie. So Evie, you are an LGBTQ+ champion for your trust, which again comprises 52 schools, and a pretty mega-sized trust. Can you tell me a bit about that role? Tell the audience what that involves.
Absolutely. So I'm the LGBTQ+ advocate, which means I'm responsible for the inclusion, the safety, and the representation of all LGBTQ+ staff and students across all 52 academies. Came about quite organically, really, back in 2021, when Oasis said they were going to launch a forum just to hear voices, hear what staff, essentially, to start with, wanted to say, and the things that were bothering us, or even the things that individual academies were doing really well. So the forum was set up, and they said we need somebody to just lead this, not to take any kind of responsibility, but just to be that voice. And I volunteered to just be the voluntary chairperson, which I quite happily took on. And I did the role for kind of 6 months or so, just as a voluntary position, not really actioning anything, just channeling those voices upwards so that our queer voices amongst the community were heard further up the pay chain, I guess. And then that made so many waves, and I think so many voices were saying the same thing, echoing the same thing, that the leadership of Oasis realised that this was a bigger deal than they thought it was going to be, and there were things that they could easily change and easily put into place if somebody spearheaded that. So then they put time and money behind the role. I said, we want somebody to drive this, put it out as an advert, which obviously I applied for, and I was put into role in February of 2022, and I'm still in role now. At a trust level, that means that I'm involved in writing policy, procedure, still amplifying those voices, but then at a trust level, making sure that those things drive forward across all academies and not just in individual regions. At academy level, I work with individual academies to support CPD. I provide CPD. I support their curriculum development so that it's bespoke to each academy. Obviously, every academy is at different kind of stages of their kind of LGBT and diversity journey. So then I individually support those academies. And then at an individual level, I relate with individual members of staff who contact me, who just want that empowerment of knowing they know what they're doing the right thing, or they don't feel like their voice is being heard. So my role is enormous, quite frankly, which I balance with being a year six teacher, but it's the impact it's having across all 52 academies is tangible now. It's not just me, there is a network of us, there are just under 100 of us across the academies that all filter into this network, and I just provide the voice and then act on what needs to be done. And then Oasis Leadership, we have a steering group through which all of these things can then actually put into practice in every academy. So the impact is being felt widely now, and the impact in certain academies is, and trust-wide now, is great.
So you have 100 people across those 52 schools. Are they mainly from the primary or mainly from the secondary, or a complete mix, or is there a pattern?
Spread across. I'd say most are secondary. We have a small pool of primaries, but then some, they come from all over. We have TAs, teachers, principals, assistant principals, hub leaders, all sorts. We are a complete kind of mishmash of people, but it means that voices from the entire academy sector are being heard, and that everybody gets to weigh in. When we write new policy, everyone gets to have their say and see themselves represented in what we're doing, which I think is really important.
And you're doing this for one day a week, is that right?
Well, I get technically officially. one day a week, but I spread my hours out as and when needed, so that I can be responsive to what's needed in the academies, that things come up at certain times, or if an academy is going through an Ofsted and they just need a little bit, or academy starting up a new pride group and I can be there for that pride group. So I'm paid for a day a week, but I use that quite flexibly.
Okay. And hopefully your school is quite accommodating for you.
My principal is incredible. She's totally on board, and anything that I want to kind of get going, she kind of trials first. But yeah, she's lovely. She's good at letting me be flexible about things.
And who are you accountable to in the Trust Central team, Evie?
There's an EDI steering group to which I might be an advocate, but there's also other advocates for other protected characteristics. So we all sit on this steering group, which is then comprised of senior leadership, the CEO, the COO, members of different parts of Oasis as well, so that what I know needs to happen, the things I'm trying to make progress on, it becomes a group effort, and it's not just me kind of as an island. This is a whole, we're all in this together real situation. So I account to the Oasis leadership, but then I might be accountable to them, but then we're all accountable together.
Yeah. Great. Hopefully that's really inspiring to some people on the call that aren't necessarily waiting for this job advert to appear in their own trust. But, you know, obviously it's come from a very kind of grassroots level, actually.
Absolutely. It grew up. It wasn't, we want this person in this role to do these things we want to happen. It's grown from what we as an LGBTQ plus community needed. The forum was there first. The role came out of the need of seeing that all these voices were saying the same things, so therefore something needed to be done.
How often do you meet as a network?
Once a half term, we meet as a network, but we have an online space as well. We have a Teams channel where we're constantly throwing things in or discussing things that are going on in between times, so that the conversation's constant, not just a once a half term. Especially seeing as, you know, schools are busy places. We can't all make it to that Tuesday afternoon. We've got staff meetings, we've got parents' evenings, etc. So the Teams channel, and we have a Padlet as well, just means that we can keep in constant contact. We have working parties working on individual projects that we kind of keep up with along the way as well, so that we never go a full half term without talking to each other and working through things that we actioned at the previous meeting.
Brilliant. That's given us a really great overview of how it works at a kind of strategic level, but also in practice and on the ground. Thank you, Evie. Let's turn to Joe then. So Joe, you've worked as an educator in primary schools and you're now a consultant, trainer and guest speaker specialising in LGBTQ plus inclusive education and supporting trans, gender, diverse young people. Can you tell me about the work that you do in this space with schools? What are they asking for help with? What are you doing when you are working with those schools that ask for your help?
Sure. So I think it's important, I guess, to remember that every school is its own community. So every school will have their own needs and their own wants, and they'll all have different starting points in terms of where they're up to with this kind of work. So my work in every school that I work with is bespoke. So I would usually typically have a discovery meeting with some of the leaders in the school to find out where they're up to, what they might need support with, and then come up with a bespoke plan of how I can support them from their starting point. But there are some common themes. So in most of my training, in fact, I think in probably all or certainly the majority of the work that I do in schools, part of that is that I share my own experience as a trans non-binary person, my experience as a teacher, what it was like to be a teacher, but also my experience as a student, what it was like to be in school with my identity. And I think that work's important because if we want to try and create more inclusive spaces, safer spaces for our LGBTQ plus young people, then we need everyone on the staff team to be on board with that and to understand why it's important. And I think part of that work is hearing the lived experience of an LGBT person so they can see some of the barriers, the challenges, and understand why it is important that we're focusing on this. And that's why I share my story. So I think that is kind of around attaching a real person to these labels that often we have preconceived ideas about that maybe come from the media or representation in films. So after I've kind of shared my story and hopefully engaged empathy in the team that I'm working with, then after that, really, it's about kind of developing the three C's. So consciousness, competence and confidence in how we create LGBT inclusive spaces. And the work that I do around that really varies depending on what the school needs. But typically, some of the things that come up really regularly at the moment is, I'm sure many of you will be aware that this year, this academic year, the guidance in keeping children safe in education updated. And there's a specific paragraph now that refers to children who are lesbian, gay, bi or trans. So a lot of my work this year has been supporting schools with how to implement that policy and what that policy means for their school, particularly the inclusion of the trans part of that policy. I think often our staff teams are more comfortable with the lesbian, gay and bisexual part of that initialism, but less sure how to support trans and gender diverse people. So that's kind of part of the work. Another thing that comes up really commonly is the confidence to challenge discriminatory language. So homophobia, transphobia, biphobia, lots of staff not feeling confident in how to challenge that. So I work with staff teams quite a lot around that and around building the policies that underpin that confidence. And then I guess the third other common thing that comes up is I do pupil facing work as well. So coming in and doing assemblies or speaking in front of students, sharing again my story, my experience and how I've come to do the work that I do now.
That's really helpful. Thank you, Joe. I think you've both given a great representation of your worlds there. That's great. So before we move on to discussing the findings of the report, I'd like to invite the audience to have a think about what challenges you face as either a trust or a school when it comes to the inclusion and safety of pupils who identify as LGBTQ+. Okay, let's go back to the findings of the report then. So we can see this significant difference, you know, around 50% to 75% in the LGBTQ plus pupils' feelings of safety in school compared to their heterosexual and cisgender peers. I'm going to start with Jo. Why do you think that pupils identifying as LGBTQ plus feel less safe in school than their heterosexual and cisgender peers?
Sure, it's a big question. It's kind of why we're here today, right? But I think when you were sharing those statistics at the beginning of this session, and when I read statistics like this, I am equally heartbroken by them because I lived in that fear. I lived in that lack of safety in my own schooling. But I'm also unsurprised by them in many ways. When I hear those findings, I'm reminded of the Stonewall Schools report and the findings of that report. I think the most recent one was 2017, but they explored the bullying that LGBTQ plus young people face, the language that they were the language they were hearing and being exposed to, and how schools and teachers were responding to this. And their findings kind of mirror what you're discussing around this lack of safety. I think for me, safety comes hand in hand with belonging. The spaces where I feel safe, the spaces where I feel like I belong. If I belong in a school, then I experience higher levels of safety there. And for me, belonging and safety happen on kind of four levels. So there's kind of intrapersonal, so feeling that belonging and safety internally with your own identity. Interpersonal, so belonging and safety with friends and the people around you, and then at a community level, belonging and safety within your school community, and then finally societally, so belonging and safety in society. So let's just imagine what an LGBTQ plus young person's experience might be through those levels, maybe side by side with a heterosexual cisgender young person. So maybe an LGBTQ plus young person in school is starting to come to terms with their identity. At the same time, they're noticing that is different to the majority of the people around them. So their belonging and their safety at the intrapersonal level will start to be challenged because they're realizing they are different to the people around them. Maybe they've had some messages that difference is not good, or that difference is not approved of. And maybe that impacts their sense of safety internally. And then there's the intrapersonal level. They've got to think about how they share this identity, this sense of who they are, how much of that they share, who they share it with, how people are going to respond, this huge level of pressure that maybe our heterosexual or cisgender young people don't have the same heightened pressure. And then we think about that on a community level in our schools. A heterosexual cisgender person might navigate our schools seeing themselves represented everywhere, whereas an LGBTQ plus young person might navigate our schools never really seeing anyone like them, or certainly never really seeing anyone like them who is succeeding and who's thriving. And then, of course, we can think about that on a societal level as well. We all, I'm sure, have seen the media, particularly this year, every week, it's a different collection of headlines that are spreading misinformation around the LGBTQ plus community, particularly around trans and gender diversity. So if we think about those levels of safety and belonging, an LGBTQ plus young person is hitting so many more barriers and challenges at each of those levels. And we can talk about how schools can improve the feelings of safety and belonging at each of those four levels. I'm sure we will go on to talk about that as we go through. But I guess kind of thinking about an LGBTQ plus young person's experience alongside somebody who doesn't have that same identity allows you maybe to start to see where that feeling of a lack of safety might come from.
Thanks. Evie, does that resonate with what you're seeing and hearing from schools in your trust?
Yeah, it really does. Yeah. From pupil feedback and from internal surveys, and I do an anonymous survey with our pride groups as well across our academies, the feedback coming from them is that they feel unsafe because there's a lot that goes unprocessed. There's a lot that is missed by our staff, sometimes mostly because they feel ill-equipped to deal with it or don't want to deal with it for fear of offending anyone. So some of it is out of not having enough knowledge, but also not having the confidence, like Joe said, to then face that and then to deal with it in a supportive and positive way and in a constructive way. So a lot of our students are asking that our staff are trained better to understand them and to use the language that they're using for themselves, that we as a community use for ourselves, but that some educators and some, well, not just educators, but people that work in schools in general, are scared to use for fear of using the wrong word or for offending people. that's society. People are generally worried of offending people more than actually are offensive. And that's what our young people are saying, that we want our staff to be able to use words like lesbian and gay and bisexual, transgender, without fear and without worrying they're going to offend anyone. It's those words come with weight. They come with this, these are bad words that we shouldn't use, especially in primary, that we shouldn't use these words with children. But it's the students, it's the children saying, we want these words used and usualized so that they're not seen as bad words, and that will make it easier for them to have their voice and feel safe that they are seen everywhere. Joe also mentioned that they don't feel represented, that they don't see themselves around school. That comes out a lot as well, that it's not in the curriculum, but it's also not surreptitiously in the curriculum. It's not in the books that we read, but not as a focus. We're not reading this book because this character is gay. We just happen to see these characters while we're reading these books. It's not everywhere like cisgendered and heterosexual students would see themselves everywhere. That's the other thing they bring up a lot, that they just don't see themselves reflected, and that does lead to that feeling unsafe. You know, I remember that as a child myself, not seeing lesbians anywhere meant that I didn't know how to be lesbian, you know.
And how you're obviously so much to unpack in there, Evie. You're also reading lead for the Trust.
Yeah.
Is that right? So how
just
have you
from my,
okay, just so from how my, have you how are you able to bring that experience or that role to bear on some of this stuff around representation in the curriculum or reading materials? Is that something you've had an impact on?
Kind of vicariously. We have, as a trust, because we're so huge, we have national lead practitioners for every subject, the national lead practitioners have written a full curriculum for all schools, which every academy has adopted but then taken and molded as their own as well. As an advocate, I have had input onto what that looks like from my perspective and how that is going to look from those students' perspective, how best to usualize that in books and in the media that we use. Not necessarily in terms of PSHE and PD, where it's a taught specific subject that's part of the curriculum, but also, like you said, seeing it in books as far down as nursery, reading things like And Tango Makes Three, so that it's part of libraries wherever you go, it's part of English lessons wherever you happen to be, but that it's also part of science lessons and maths lessons, because it's usual, it's part of everyday life.
Yeah.
So yeah, I have been able to take not take a lead in that, but I've been a part of it.
It was amazing, the maturity of those students saying it's actually the staff need education. It's just such a lovely way of flipping CPD, isn't it? Great. So what would you say in terms of supporting, I'm asking Evie this actually, and then I'll get Joe's perspective in a second. In terms of supporting LGBTQ+ students themselves in your schools, what do you think has worked well and what has worked less well as an approach?
That's a really broad question. I've got to say, the first thing is to be really proactive about it and vocal about it. Having someone in a role like mine means that it is not necessarily in the spotlight, but students see it and staff see it and know that something is being done, that this is important to us, this work is important, and we're not shying away from these, what can be sometimes quite difficult conversations. In terms of what works, setting up pride groups, rainbow groups, diversity groups, depending on what that looks like in different locations, has given our students a place to feel safe. In some academies, that looks like it is a rainbow group and it is incredibly LGBTQ+ kind of oriented. Some academies, it is a diversity group and it kind of covers all different protected characteristics. But it depends on the setting of the academy and what the local area and the community will kind of support that moving forward. That's been really, really useful to some of our students. Also, having someone on staff to whom they can go. I don't have any with me. We had badges made that are the Oasis symbol turned rainbow. I don't even have a mine on me right now, sorry. But our staff wear them so that they are identifiable by our students, that they are a safe person to go to, that they can have open and honest conversations with that person if they need to question their sexual identity, whether they need to talk about whatever's going on in their head in terms of gender diversity or whatever. That's really helped some of our students just know that there is someone that they can go to that is a safe person to have those conversations with. At a trust level, I guess the best thing has been putting in reporting procedures so that every member of staff knows, you see this, this is how we deal with it, so that there is a commonality to how we respond to whether it's homophobic bullying, whether it is transphobic language, whether it's something much worse. But there is a series of steps to go through. There's categories to list these on CPOM so that the language is all the same, so that our students know that we are responding to those things that they're bringing up, those feelings of unsafe, being not safe. There are procedures in place for supporting those students, if that makes sense.
And it's consistent, yeah. Mm. Jo, so an essential part of creating an LGBTQ plus friendly school culture is clearly to have staff who are on board with your vision. And I know that's a lot of what you do. How can schools and trusts fully equip their staff to support these pupils?
Great question. So I think the first thing, like I said, is getting them to understand why it is important. So getting them to connect with the lived experiences of LGBT people so that they hear what it is like for a young LGBT person to navigate a school. So they understand why it's important that we're having these conversations. So it's engaging that empathy to start off with. And then the next thing is starting to think, I said those three C's about consciousness, competence, and confidence. Now, I recognise with every school that I work with that the majority of people who are working in our schools now, certainly the majority of people leading our schools, were educated themselves in an education system that wasn't inclusive for LGBT people. Indeed, many of us were educated when there was specific legislation to ensure that it systematically couldn't be inclusive. So if that's the case, then there's a lot of work for us to do to change our understanding of what we can and can't do in schools and what we can and can't talk about in schools. And I think that's where that lack of confidence comes from, that we haven't got the framework or the experiences of an inclusive school to fall back on when we're trying to rebuild our own. So for me, it's actually trying to reimagine our school. And it's as much about unlearning as it is learning. And the unlearning part can be really difficult. I think we have a book that's coming about later this year, which is exactly on this theme. And we talk about there being kind of four pillars of inclusive education. So maybe our four starting points, if we're going to start to try and do this work. The first one that we suggest is that we believe every school should have a common inclusion goal. So a goal that you have all agreed on with your staff, with your students, with your community about inclusion in your school. So the one that we always say is that we think every person in our school should be free to be themselves, feel safe, seen, supported, and feel like they belong. And we all agree with that, right? Like I'm yet to come across an educator who says, I don't want children to feel like they belong. Of course we do. But if we don't name it, if we don't say it out loud, then we can lose that goal. So name that common inclusion goal, have it in your policies, have it displayed in your school. Make sure that new families sign up to that goal when they join your school. Make it part of your school's experience. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that beyond that common inclusion goal, we need to develop a common inclusive language. Evie's touched on some of this. Our young people are, the language around LGBT identities is developing. That doesn't mean LGBT identities are new, but the language which we are using to explain ourselves and to define ourselves and discuss it in a meaningful way is new and developing. Our young people are using lots of language that we need to be familiar with and we need to know. In my training, I always show a list of words and I say, these aren't words that I've randomly selected. These are words that I've heard children and young people use in school in the last 12 months. And we need to have that common understanding of that language so that we can meaningfully discuss it. So we've got that common inclusion goal, developing that common inclusive language. And then the next two things are, first of all, curriculum. And then fourthly, that fourth point is representation and visibility. I won't speak on those two too much because I think Evie's already done that. But the four pillars that we say of inclusive education, that common inclusion goal, common inclusive language, curriculum, representation and visibility. And all of this work should be underpinned by pupil voice. I go into some schools sometimes and the leaders say to me, oh, we don't have any homophobic bullying in our school. And I say, sure, have you asked? And of course they haven't. And the reason we're here today is because of pupil voice. We've heard what the pupils had to say. We've identified the problem, and then we can try and build the solutions. And it's the same in your schools. You've got to ask the question to find out what the problem is so that you can start to build the solution.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. So I want to just talk a bit about barriers now, because I'm sure the work that you're doing and the work that schools and trusts who have come along to listen today is not always straightforward. It's not a case of coming in and just, you know, clicking your fingers and we've got a great policy and everybody's suddenly feeling safe. So Evie, would you like to talk a little bit about the barriers that you have faced as a trust in terms of implementing some of this and how you have overcome some of those barriers and what advice you would give to others?
But in terms of overcoming them, I think that's an ongoing battle. I don't think anyone can speak to overcoming them, and you know, we're all doing brilliantly, because this is an ongoing battle that is societal, I guess, and kind of feeds into our schools. So one of the biggest barriers we come across is I guess you'd call it buy-in. It's getting everybody on board with that this is what we're going to do, these are the steps we're going to take, and this is why. Like Joe said, nobody disagrees that this is the right thing to be doing and that our students need to feel safe and seen and secure, but it can be quite difficult getting staff to commit to actually doing something about it, because of that feeling of, I don't want to offend, or I don't want to rock the boat, or I don't want to be seen to be different. So that's been difficult, but I guess as a trust, we have an advantage in that twice a year I can speak to the entire trust, 5,000 and something staff, and everyone can have the same message. So therefore the buy-in stakes is easier, because I can talk to everybody at once and everybody hears the same message, so that everybody has the same buy-in. It doesn't mean that there aren't people who would rather not, and that is the kind of the wall that we'll constantly hit. But I think that is overcome by just sheer persistence and having someone whose job it is to keep driving at that, so that it isn't spread out amongst the schools. That's brilliant, because it means that there is a voice that is loud. But if you have one person for whom this is their sole job, this is what we do, and we keep going until we get everybody on side, I think that is incredibly useful. I don't think we would be where we are now if we hadn't had somebody spearheading it. I don't mean that necessarily has to be me. I mean, if we hadn't had somebody pushing this agenda forward. The other thing we come across is society. It's that the communities that our schools are in, we often get a lot of pushback from communities and parents that they don't believe in LGBTQ plus issues, people, whatever. That gets a lot of pushback. But that, again, that has come from knowing that our staff have got our backing, that they're doing the right thing. So we wrote almost scripts, but not quite. They're how our ethos translates into we're doing the right thing, so that our staff have got a document they can go back to, and when a member of the community or a parent kind of challenges, we don't want our child to know this, they've got something they can go back to and say, right, well, our ethos says this and the law says this, and therefore we are doing the right thing because of X, Y, and Z. It's having that common language again, the same as with how we report, having commonality to everything, and knowing that our staff are well supported with almost the tools to not fight back at it, but push back gently.
So yeah, that's a good point. And we've had lots of, we've had a lot of comments, I think you'll probably have seen on the chat, relating to faith, which is, I think, partly what you're alluding to there. I'm going to read one of them and maybe one of you could respond. We have a seven-year-old gender fluid child. The biggest challenge we have in a multi-faith primary school is cultural. Many of our parents do not have an understanding and refuse to have any issue related to non-heterosexual relationships to be discussed with their child. Joe, do you want to respond to that question, and maybe, I don't know about giving advice, but
Sure. Yeah. I work with a lot of schools that have majority faith communities. And the reality is that all of these statements are true. There are some people of faith who have a tension or a friction with LGBTQ plus identities. There are some people of faith who are LGBT plus themselves. And as schools, we have to protect and serve both of those groups. All those things are true. How do we bring them together? And for me, it's really about taking a holistic approach to diversity, equity, and inclusion. If you take a holistic approach to making sure that we accept and we respect diversity and difference in our school, that's where we start to have those conversations in a powerful way. So often in schools, we talk about celebrating identities, celebrating LGBTQ plus people. For some people with particular religious beliefs, the idea of celebrating that will feel too much for them. I'm not saying we should use the word tolerate. I think tolerate is an awful word. It's such a low standard to set for our children and young people. But we could use the language of acceptance and respect. We're not asking people to celebrate, but we're asking you to accept and respect, because that's what we do in this school. So think about the language we use and how we can bring the conversation into more of an inclusive language. I also think that there's two other points I would make there. The first one, and Evie kind of suggested this with the scripts that she mentioned, know your legal duty as an educator. Through the Equality Act and through the Relationships and Sex Education Guidance and through Keeping Children Safe in Education, those three different pieces of legislation mean that it is your legal duty as an educator to create a safe space for LGBTQ plus people. And what that means is that you have a safety net to support those challenging conversations. So you're not saying, I have decided that we're going to do this in our school. And you're not saying, I think we should talk about this in your school. We're saying, actually, it's our legal duty as an educational establishment to do this work. These are the things that show that any school that you go to will have the same legal obligation in the UK. So you can fall back to that safety net of that. But also, if you've established that common inclusive goal, like I mentioned earlier, and that's in your policies, your families sign up to the school with that goal in mind, all of your young people know about it. Again, that's a safety net that supports that conversation. You can say, actually, we've agreed in our school that we want everyone to feel like they belong. That includes this group of people. And make the point that we can't, as educators, you know, we think about the Equality Act 2010, there's 9 protected characteristics. None of us have a right to pick and choose which of those we protect. It's our legal and moral duty to protect them all from discrimination and to teach the acceptance and respect of all of those groups. And often that's the conversation that holds the most power with people of faith, is to explain to them that if you want your child to come to this school and to be able to be a Christian in this space or to be a Muslim in this space, we absolutely accept and respect that. And we will make sure everyone does the same. But we need to make sure that's true for all these other minoritized groups as well. So I guess there's a few things there, kind of how you bring the temperature down on the language by talking about acceptance and respect, how you use the legislation and your policies as a safety net to support that conversation. And then the final thing that I said there was around how you can talk about the holistic approach. And one more thing, sorry if there's time, is around communication and consultation. When I say consultation, I don't mean asking for permission. This is a legal duty of your school. You're not asking for permission, but in communicating your inclusion work and in offering the opportunity for consultation and discussion, it just means that these conversations that might be happening on WhatsApp groups that you're not in, parents, happen in your head teacher's office, and you can be part of that conversation if you offer that.
Yeah. I think we might just do a very quick poll, actually, on that note. You should see something coming up on the screen now. Fantastic. It would be great, audience members, if you could contribute to this quick poll. It is completely anonymous, so we're not going to not be naming and shaming anyone, don't worry. Just if you could take 20 seconds to fill that in. And then just press submit when you've done that. So do you think your trust or school, depending on which environment you're coming from, is doing enough to make sure that pupils who identify as LGBTQ plus feel safe in school? Yes, no, not sure. And then a question around how confident you are that those policies or strategies are improving the feelings of safety. One thing, when I was when we were preparing for this webinar today, I did speak to a number of people in trust particularly, but also in single schools, who I thought would be great to be involved in this. And confidence really came up as a reason to not do it. And I think that really speaks to what you said, actually, that there's this kind of sense of, I don't want to get it wrong. It's not about, you know. Okay, here we go. We've got the results come up there. So we have 28% saying yes, they feel that school is doing enough, 37% no, 35% not sure. I mean, just over a quarter feel that they're doing enough. I think, Evie, how do you feel about that?
I think that's fairly reflective, because I think Oasis would have been there before we started on this journey. I don't think there's any shame in that. You have to be there before you can start a journey. So yeah, knowing that things aren't where you want them to be is the basis of making progress.
Yeah. And Joe, what about the second question about confidence? Actually, quite high numbers there, 53% saying they feel somewhat confident. What would your response to that be? Would you think that's a fair reflection from the schools that you've worked with?
I think that's great. I think to have 53% of the people on this call feeling somewhat confident is such a great strong starting point. I would love to see those 53% feeling very confident. The line in the new guidance in Keeping Children Safe in Education, the sentence says that we need to provide safe spaces for LGBT young people to speak out and share their concerns with members of staff. And so often that's been misunderstood in schools as a single point of contact, as one member of staff who is the safe space for these LGBT plus young people. But what the guidance is actually saying is members of staff, all of us. So I guess hopefully today has gone some way to start to boost those confidence levels, because I want, and I think we need, for all of our members of staff to feel somewhat, if not very, confident in having these conversations in schools.
Well, thank you to both of our panel for sharing their insights and experiences with us today. If you're looking for more support with any of the issues raised, we'd like to suggest a few helpful resources. Firstly, Jo's podcast, Pride and Progress, features in-depth discussions with LGBTQ plus educators on a range of matters such as LGBTQ plus inclusive PE and relationships and sex education. Their book with Dr. Adam Brett, Pride and Progress, Making Schools LGBT plus Inclusive Spaces, is available for pre-order. If you're a member of The Key, you can use our resources to help you create an LGBTQ plus inclusive environment, from our whole school and curriculum audits on LGBTQ plus inclusivity to advice on covering LGBTQ plus content in your curriculum, advice on how to support trans pupils, reading lists for staff, and more. We'll link to all these resources and others in the description.